Good to be here and see everybody again. Thanks for coming to practice together a little bit. Welcome for the first time. Yeah. And is this your first time? Second time. Okay, cool. We missed the last one because it was, I don't know, what was happening? It was something. What was it?
No, it was
protests. Oh, yeah, there's protests, right. Right. Yes, they do. So I just wanted to look a little bit at this Pirkei Avot. It's from chapter 4, number 21. And it says, Rabbi Yaakov Omer, meaning Rabbi Yaakov is saying, or used to say, Ha'olam hazeh, this world, domei lifros dor. It is like a lobby. This world is like a lobby. Mipnei ha'olam haba, before the world that is coming. Hatakein atzmecha, you should prepare yourself or correct yourself or fix yourself. Ba'prozdor, in the lobby, kedei she'tikanes latraklin, so that you can enter the banquet hall. So on the surface, you know, it sounds like a typical religious kind of idea, you know, that this world is just a, you know, a preparation for heaven or for the world to come, for the more spiritual thing that's coming. And you should prepare yourself, meaning you should live a good life and so on, so that you can enter the heaven. But these kinds of teachings frame things in those kinds of religious constructs because of when they were written, because that's the language that people would understand. But it's actually much deeper than that. The term that's used for the real thing, the banquet, right, is Olam Haba, means the world that is coming, the world that is coming. And the lobby is Olam HaZeh. Zeh means this in Hebrew, and it has the connotation of that which we're pointing to, you know. And if we're pointing to it, it means we have some concept of what it is. So in a sense, it's not really talking about reality, it's talking about our concept of reality, the way we understand the world, the way we conceive of the world, and particularly what our relationship is with the world in time through our mind. In other words, what's the story that we impose on the world with ourselves in the world? What's our story in the world that we're living right now? That's Olam HaZeh, that's this world that we're living in. But the real world is actually Olam Haba, meaning that it's not something that's some solid thing that our mind can grasp. It's something that's constantly becoming, Olam Haba, the world that is coming. And in another sense, that word coming, Haba, is that it's like it wants to come to us. It wants to break through to us. It wants to make contact with us. But in order to do that, we have to prepare ourselves in the world that we naturally live in, which is the world of our mind, the world of our story, the world of our mental concept of the world rather than the actual reality. So how do we do that? How do we takein? How do we fix ourselves or prepare ourselves in this world? There's different ways we could go with it, but the way I'm seeing it now is that we need our mind, and we need our story in order to transcend our mind and story. Because it's talking about Olam HaZeh as a lobby, you know, which implies that it's this little space. And again, it's this imagery of being narrow, like the chant we did, Tsar, which means worry or constriction, and Mitzrayim, which is narrowness. Because our concept of the world is obviously so much more narrow than what reality actually is. But it also implies that there's something outside, right? Like there's the outside, and then you come into the lobby, and then you go into the banquet hall. So what's the outside? The outside is the vastness of unconscious being. You know, like this cup, I assume, is probably on the outside. This cup is not conscious at all. It's not living in a story, but it's also not conscious of reality. It's just a manifestation of being that doesn't have a consciousness. So as we organisms, mind-body units that have somehow made it from inanimate being into this conscious being, do so in this lobby of the human mind. And we can pass through the lobby, we can go beyond the lobby into the place where existence can finally enjoy itself. You know, it's like God's consciousness can be born within us and enjoy itself rather than being trapped in these drama, sorrow-creating units that we are. As long as we're in the lobby. But because we have these minds and these narrative-creating minds, these drama-creating minds, we can also use our mind to understand what we're talking about now and to direct our awareness out of that constriction, out of that lobby. And we do that not by reaching towards something in our mind, right? Not by having some imagination of what we're getting toward and reaching toward that, but actually making contact with reality. And the actual experience of finally getting out of that lobby is, it's called a banquet because it's so enjoyable, it's so liberating. In and of itself, it's so nourishing. Because the energy that was constricted in the lobby is now, it's the same energy is now free to enjoy, is free to be blissful, is free to be unconstricted and experience that vastness that it is when it's not constricted by the mind. So I just want to open it up, and if anybody has anything that you'd like to say, you'd like to share, or a question that you'd like to ask. And I just want to request that we not do crosstalk. So meaning anybody who wants to say something should be able to say it without someone else answering them, unless you specifically want that. Unless you say, hey, I'm putting this out to the whole group. I'm not just asking Brian, I'm asking everyone. You can do that if you want. But if you're asking me a question, other people don't jump in to answer. And also, you don't have to worry that this is recording you because it's near my mouth, so it's not going to really pick you up very well, and I'll repeat your question if you have a question.
Brian, it sounds like the core of what you're saying is the reality that we, each of us, experience is filtered through our stories of what we're seeing. And if we can see the actual, if we can notice what's story and what's reality, then we can see through that screen and experience reality on a deeper level.
Right.
I think that's the core of what you're saying. You're nodding.
Pretty much. pretty much.
Acknowledgement.
Yeah.
But the story you told to tell this,
yeah,
is the most constricted, knotty interpretation. It starts off, the text is saying, this world, and then some unbelievable imaginary world up above. And you're saying, no, he doesn't really mean imaginary. He means,
right,
I think you said, Adon Olam, the world to come.
Yeah.
But really, you're talking about the world that we think is here, and the world that is actually here. The world that is actually here is not the world to come. It already is here. And so using that analogy to say it, for me, is a kind of very knotty story that constricts what I think is the clear intention underneath it.
Yeah, that could be so. So the comment was that the Mishnah from Pirkei Avot is kind of a knotty, constricted, maybe confusing. You didn't say the word confusing, but maybe. Does that work?
Is he saying what you're saying? I get what you're saying, but not in that language.
Right. Yeah. So, well, we'll never know, really. but from the point of view of knowing, you know, what, from the point of view of Olam Haba, reading these types of things, that's just, it seems obvious to me that that's what it's talking about. I don't really know what the intention of what he was saying. But the words to me seem pretty precise. The fact that it's called Olam Haba, for example, one of the main things that our mind does, and it's kind of a trap that we fall into very naturally, it's a natural human trap of thinking to fall into, is actually what you just said. And this is something that's often said in a lot of spiritual teaching, because any words that we're using to express, of course, are just hints at a process that we're trying to get going, right? There's a spiritual process. It's not about a philosophy or about having the right intellectual construct to describe things. The words are just there to help us to do the work, to do the practice, so that we can enjoy what is actually there for us to enjoy, rather than being stuck in something that we don't need to be stuck in, right? So one of those traps is this idea of things being the way they are. Because things aren't the way they are. Because there is no solid way things are. The universe is in motion all the time. So when we say that this is the way it is, what we're doing is we're taking a snapshot of our comprehension of things. And that's useful to do that. It's not to say that we shouldn't do that at all, because in the context of our social lives and our human story, we need to do that to function. But the problem is that we tend to paint a picture of how things are, and then when that picture is something undesirable, then we feel trapped by it. But actually, what are we really trapped by? We're trapped by our concept of how things are. How things really are is this constant, alive movement, right? If we just bring our awareness into what actually is now, there isn't really an is, there's an is-ing, right? The is-ness, there is an is also, but it's not any particular thing, right? The is-ness is just existence itself. But any particular thing, that like our bodies, our minds, our emotions, anything around us, all the actual things are not is. They are ising, they are becoming, they are changing. Some much more slowly than others, some much more fast than others. But since we don't tend to think of things that way, our mind tends to picture things as being a certain way, as being solid, right, as being static in some kind of sense, right? Even, and it doesn't have to be, it's not a philosophical thing, it's just something we do automatically, right? We think of our situations as solid, right? This is what I'm doing in my life now. This is what I have, this is what's happening in my body now. But it's just a snapshot. There's so much more going on every moment, our mind is focusing on some snapshot of our narrative. And if we don't like that snapshot, then we feel trapped in it. But really, we're trapped in a mental snapshot. And when our consciousness is allowed to spill out of that box or to boil over from that box, there's lots of different ways it can happen, actually. Right? When we're meditating, we're allowing it to kind of seep out of that box. These are just imagery for describing something that's internal. But another way we might say it is that the box itself is allowed to just sort of fade and dissolve, and the consciousness that's in it is allowed to expand and experience what it's like just to be consciousness without being trapped in a box. So to me, the imagery was good. I like the imagery of being in the box as being in the lobby. And the banquet is this, you know, it's a common imagery in the Mishnah and the Gemara, actually. It's a common rabbinic image of, and also in early Christianity, too, right? I think in the Gospels, Jesus talks about the banquet. I can't remember which one it is. Do you know which one I'm talking about? Anyway, it's one of Jesus' parables. He talks about everybody coming to the banquet. But anyway, the point is that the banquet is a common metaphor in 2,000 years ago Jewish thought as the thing that's nice, that's good. It's a Buddhist. There's a Buddhist metaphor of a banquet too. Talks about. I remember reading it in a book of a Zen teacher, Steve Hagen book, and he opened the book with it, and he said, "There's the banquet is set before us, but we don't even know we're hungry. We can't feel that we're hungry." And that's how he painted the human problem. We can paint it all different ways, but there's something off in our awareness that doesn't allow us to actually be satisfied by something that is already there to satisfy us, right?
My constriction when you were starting to read and describe went to the Holy of Holies, the temple, and the lobby, and that banquet table is now, all of that goes to that. I'm just curious of how that teaching might correlate somehow to the temple itself and the expansiveness or the deepening of making the connection in a different way.
Mm.
There's some language that comes from that, from the temple to their words.
Well, it's neat how all the different metaphors point to different aspects of the experience, right? These are just metaphors. In the metaphor of the temple, then the Holy of Holies is actually a small space, right? It's not an expansive space. And the more holy and deep you get, the smaller it gets. So that's true in a sense too, because what we're doing is we are making smaller and smaller our level of involvement with our own thought. You have to kind of reduce that and reduce that and reduce that. And you have to reach a critical mass with it before you can actually see what's going on in yourself. You know, you can begin to meditate and you can calm your mind and you can experience some calm. And that's nice. But for a while, what it feels like to most people is that you're doing a technique to calm yourself down. That's what it feels like to most people. It just feels like your mental energy is frenetic or stressful or whatever, and you do a technique to calm down. It doesn't have to, it's not necessarily more than that. But the more you practice and the more you bring the practice not just to the pillow, but all throughout the day, like meditate all day long. Like bring your mind to what's happening and let go of excess thought and do that more and more, then the next thing that usually happens is that you start unblocking energy that was normally blocked, like the normal walls that were built, that were building the constructs of reality that we live in, start dissolving or start breaking down. And then pain can come up, because there's a certain amount of emotional pain we have from our lives that starts breaking through. And then that's not very pleasant. So we tend to want to go back, like, oh, I don't like this, right? Let me just go back to the way it was. But if we keep going forward with it and we allow that pain to come up and we allow it to happen, then it becomes more and more obvious that our mind is conditioning everything, and it becomes more and more natural to let go of that excess chattering of the mind, and not just the chattering, but the kind of the walls that it builds up, the constructs that it causes us to live within. And so that gets less and less and less. And so in that sense, it's kind of like we are moving toward the eye of a hurricane. And it's a small place, right? There's also that imagery in the Bible of the still small voice. It's a small voice. So there's this small, so something is getting smaller and something else is getting wider. So there has to be a certain kind of discipline. Not a discipline in the sense of getting yourself to do something, but discipline in terms of a clarity, a more and more constant clarity of what you're doing with your mind, moment to moment, and a willingness to practice that more and more, so that you can reduce that world, and that world gets smaller and smaller. The whole imaginary world of your mind can get smaller in the sense, not in the sense of being trapped in it and being constricted, but in the sense of its activity. Its activity gets smaller. But the actual aliveness of it, in a sense, gets bigger, because many people find that as they go on with this kind of thing, that the creativity they experience becomes much more alive, because those constructs aren't as solid and strong. So the mind can just be do what it does, which is create, right? The creativity is very natural. The whole universe is creating, and it's happening in us too. Is that helpful? Maybe. Okay.
Leaders that have spoken about how it's the challenge often is to maintain a certain level when you're out and about in the world. So the cultivation of creativity and being able to, for me, being aware and being present can be very painful when you are with people, and I'm not, for me, not talking about my clients, I'm talking about equal people, that are equal to me, that I'm not a change agent for.
Right, right.
That are kind of stuck and holding really tight to stress and pain, and this is, that it's difficult and it's hard and that's the reality, which is often when I'm encountering, because I'm not in spiritual community.
Yeah.
And that is, you do the work, you do spiritual work, there's a rawness that comes.
Yeah, right.
Because you're present with reality and you become more vulnerable and more creative and less protected.
Right.
And so that's kind of, my question I come back to is, and then I want to kind of pull back and not meditate and not be open, because it's hard to be out there raw with all this energy. So I don't know if you have any insight. I think you know what I'm talking about. You probably heard me talk about this before.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, going and being, you know, leaving my world and surrounding myself constantly and consistently with spiritually high people or whatever that means. It's kind of a judgment, but...
Well, yeah. I mean, what you're saying is... I mean, part of what you're saying... is very, my experience of it is very different, and part of it is very the same. The part that's very the same is the rawness and openness and vulnerability. The part that's different is that, and maybe this is the case for you, I don't know, but the doing of the spiritual practice, like sitting and meditating and davening and so on, heals me from whatever I felt in the world that was irritating, or that my rawness was painful. I was experiencing pain, you know, that it's very healing for me. So there's no temptation to like go back and at this point, you know, that at a certain point, like I was talking about before, when the pain is coming up within yourself. And of course I'm only talking from my own experience ever. So that was my experience, that pain coming up in myself made the temptation to go back. But doing the practice, meditation and chanting or whatever your practice is at this point, you know, it can be very healing. So do not experience that as healing?
Yes, but it also wipes away a lot of my delusion. So I get to see things really clearly. Like I get to see people around me and exactly how stuck in some certain things are. I get to, you know, see more clearly.
Yeah.
And that piece is painful.
Right. Yeah, I remember many years ago I was attending something like this that there was another teacher teaching, and I was there in the group. It was hundreds of people, and someone came up and was asking a question, and this person was in incredible amount of pain. And as I was sitting there watching, I thought, oh my God, I would hate to be in the position of that teacher. Because it just seemed like it would be so heartbreaking and you know, it just seemed like such an intense job to be the space for people who were in such incredible pain, you know. And so I was. It kind of shocked me in the sense of like, this is. I do similar work to that, but not at all on the level that this guy was doing, and so I was like, I don't know if I want to. In that sense, I was like, I want to go back. I don't want to teach because someone like that might come, and having to deal with that. But over time, I realized that that's just an exaggerated form of what's happening in life all the time anyway, regardless of whether you're a therapist or a teacher or whatever. That's what's going to happen. We people are in a lot of pain around us, and situations happen that are going to be heartbreaking and painful. I mean, that's just the way it is. There's not really a solution to that other than to know that when... You know, if you weren't there when the person was stuck and in pain, they'd still be stuck and in pain. Like whether you're there or not is not really making. If you weren't there, that doesn't mean the person's going to be better. So ultimately, then you have to see that. Oh well, actually, I'm really concerned about myself. I'm concerned about being in pain myself because I'm in the presence of this person who's in pain. And that you really shouldn't worry about because you know you're going to heal. You know that it's not going to hurt you really at all. It's going to be painful. Seeing other people's pain is painful, but it doesn't hurt you ultimately. Your own awareness is completely self-regenerating. It's mobile. It's alive. It doesn't get wounded. It's not like a physical thing that gets gashed and then it's just gashed permanently. So then the next step is, well, then I am there. And so there might be an opportunity to be helpful in some kind of way. And if you're open to that, then that will happen sometimes, and sometimes it won't, because, you know, there has to be, you have to get the signal, there has to be something relational happen. But also, you should know that sometimes if you're just being open and aware and awake and someone's in pain, they very well might be getting help from you without you even knowing it. It's happened many times, both stories people have told, my own experience of being helped, and people telling me later that they were helped in ways that I had no idea or wouldn't have known at the time, because there's things happening on an energetic level that's beyond like what we can do, you know, where the impulse is like, let me do something, let me help, let me fix, right? And sometimes there is something to do, but a lot of times there's not, because there's nothing to do. There's no readiness, there's no openness, there's no task to be done. And yet, mind is very susceptible. Very, very susceptible. We're very gullible, really, you know? And so that's why it's painful, because we feel people's pain, people come with pain and we feel it, because our mind is very gullible. But it's also gullible the other way. And our openness and awareness will be is actually influencing people around us all the time. So, yeah. So,
for me, when people coming to me in pain,
yeah,
isn't painful for me, because there's an openness here.
Right, because they've right. come to you with the open, yeah. Absolutely, right. Right,
right. You know, right. Whether I help or not, it's just the mm-hmm. acknowledgement. It's that, I think it's the stuckness and the stubbornness and that kind of
yeah.
intensity and the intellectual gobbledygook and it gets yeah. thrown like this. You
know, I agree.
That, the more I open, I'm like,
yeah.
it hurts.
Yeah.
It's not like they're coming to me saying I'm in pain. Then there's an opening. So
yeah.
You're saying something. You said something, and I'll let me. You said something like, I know I'm pain and I know I'll heal.
Yeah.
There was a piece in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the tendency is that when the negative energy comes, we don't like it. So one way is to like somehow block ourselves from it, like shield ourselves from it, right? And so that's like a closing kind of feeling. And if you don't do that, if you let yourself feel it, there's another thing that happens, which is to let it come in, but then to hold on to it inside and not to let it flow back out again. And that's
that?
Even harder to not do.
How do you do that? That's what I'm asking. Because it comes in, most of us are like, how do you let it flow back out?
Well, because in order to hold on to it and not let it flow back out, there has to be a mental component. Mm-hmm. It's not just in your body. And if in order to grab onto the negative energy and keep it in yourself, there has to be a mental component to that. There's a thought component. The thought component is some kind of thought like some comment on it, like that's really horrible. Yeah, whatever it is, whatever the thinking is about that negative energy, when we think about it, that's the means by which we energetically hold on to it. And so the only real task we have is to be aware of that the mind is doing that, and then to relax that. And then that allows it to flow out as it flows out. It doesn't mean it disappears instantly, but it means you're not holding on to it anymore. The mind is the means by which we hold on to things, is with thought. And then the experience of it is not in the mind, it's in the body. It's very energetic, it's in your emotions. But once the mind lets go, then your emotions can flow again. And, you know, just like something going down the river, you pour a bunch of gunk in the river, depending on how much you pour in, you know, you'll see the gunk going by for a while. But eventually, as long as you stop pouring it in and as long as you haven't set up a dam to keep it there, then it'll eventually just go by.
That's great.
Right? So pouring more in means staying in the presence of the negativity, someone else's, or generating it yourself. holding on to it or setting up the dam means that person isn't even here anymore, right? The experience is over, but I'm still thinking about it, and so it's still going inside me. Yeah. I think, okay, Jordan, yeah.
I wanted to say something more about Rev Pinchas.
Yeah.
I have read an essay recently about ancient Chinese poetry, and there were these descriptions of the poets, and they were either scholars or diplomats or successful businessmen, and then they left it all to live a simple country life, and their poems consist of single lines of exquisite precision and beauty. And I was thinking, this is what Rev Pinchas was about, because they had lived worldly lives, and now they were leaving that and finding something else. Simple, austere even, but exquisite. And also the point was that they were older too, which I liked.
Right.
Hearing that. They had lived lives in the world and had left those lives for something rustic and simple, and exquisite and precise. And in a sense, I felt that's what he was saying too. You know, the worldly life is the lobby, which kept them busy for a long time.
Right.
And then they were able to drop it and leave it and go off.
Right.
And around those exquisite lines of poetry, there's this great silence. You know? There's this great, a flower, a petal of a flower. And you can almost see an entire field of blossoming, poppies or whatever. So I just wanted to bring that up because that's what came to my mind.
Nice. Nice. When you were talking about it, there were two things that I said. I said a Reb Pinchas story about when he says that don't think you're praying to God, prayer is God. And then this line was actually Reb Yaakov. This is Rabbi Yaakov. So, but Rabbi Pinchas also relates to what you were saying, so I was following it for a while, and then I realized you were talking about... Right, but they were both. But they're, because Reb Pinchas also was, in a way, he was kind of the opposite, because he didn't want to be involved in the world. But it wasn't time yet to not be involved in the world. He was young and he liked to just really separate from everything. And in a sense, he was blocking the knowledge of the banquet hall from flowing into the lobby, you know. In a sense, there's this, to sort of change the metaphor a little bit, if you're in the lobby, you want to know that it's a lobby. You want to know that your job is to prepare yourself to enter the banquet hall, right? But if you don't know that, if someone else is in the banquet hall and they're not even letting people know in the lobby what's going on, then that's not very nice, you know. So it says, you know, it says in here in a different Mishnah, it says someone who refuses to teach Torah is liable to the death penalty. It's like the worst sin to withhold the spiritual information that someone needs. And so Reb Pinchas was like that at first, you know, until a certain turning point in his life. And then he realized that he had to do his duty to, he couldn't just enjoy it for himself. There's a Yiddish insult that says, the insult is he makes a very good Shabbos for himself. So even though sharing it and enjoying it and teaching and everything exposes you to things that are unpleasant, you know, you have to learn how to be an open door through which it can flow and flow back out again. because it's our duty to, we're part of a whole. It's not just about us individuals.
I understood most of what you were saying to her, but could you distinguish between gullible and empathetic?
I was using gullible in a very loose way. I didn't mean gullible literally. I meant empathetic. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But in a way, it's gullible too, because sometimes people will be saying negative things, and we can get drawn into the negativity sometimes by believing what they're saying in a straightforward, gullible way. But other times, we can just develop our own reactive negativity to their negativity, right? Like we develop our own negative story to their negative story because we don't want to hear their negative story. So it's like a deeper level of gullible.
What if it has nothing to do with words or stories?
Yeah, just picking up on people's energy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
What do I do?
Well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Meaning, being open and not clinging with our minds. When we're open, it's true, we will experience negative energy that's coming or that we're around, but eventually that ends, right? Our situation is constantly changing. There's no situation, we're not going to be trapped in a room with negativity forever. And even if we were trapped in the room, the negativity, whoever was the source of the negativity would stop doing it eventually. Like, it's nothing is forever. Things change.
Negativity, it's just the intensity of what's happening, whether it's negative or positive.
Yeah.
A little overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I don't want to retreat.
Yeah.
So just practice in the moment, is basically what you're saying?
Well, it sounds like you're talking about a specific situation, so I don't know.
No.
Oh, you're not? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, yeah, like I was saying, all situations are temporary, so we don't have to worry so much that we're being exposed to whatever it is, intensity, negativity, whatever it is. It's going to be happening for the duration that it's happening. And if we try to shield ourselves and block ourselves off, then we create tension in ourselves. And you don't have to do that, because even if you're open and vulnerable, yes, you will feel whatever intensity is going on, but it will end, and it will also, you will renew yourself. You will be regenerated, because that's the nature of our consciousness, is that it doesn't get permanently dented. It is able to heal itself very quickly if we give it the space to do that. It's hard to remember that in the moment when you're being assaulted. Yeah, I don't mean literally assaulted. If you're literally assaulted, then you have to protect yourself. But I just mean assaulted by energy. I just took the BART in from San Francisco because I came in on the plane today, as I was saying before. It was very calm when I first got on it at the airport, and then in the city, it was during rush hour, and it was filled with people that were all very tensely contracted, and because they wanted to, people don't want to make eye contact because they're afraid of who they might be making eye contact with.
They've been doing it all day long, and they just want to go.
Yeah, and so everybody's got their thing and their thing. And everybody's very contracted, and, you know, and I'm sure sometimes there are people who are disruptive, but there wasn't anyone like that at this point. It was just a lot of very, very close people pretending that no one else was there. Just, you know, very tense. So I'm recommending don't be so tense. Yeah.
With regard to empathy, it's a real gift that
yeah.
people who teachers or good therapists have huge amounts of empathy to really be able to understand the people coming to them with
problems. Yeah.
And it sounds like a way of kind of releasing that in yourself is to say a bracha, to say a prayer like, what a blessing that I have this empathy. You know, notice, this is my empathy.
To have gratitude for it, And it reminds me of the story of Reb Zusha. Maybe some of you know, but Reb Zusha was a person who had such great empathy that he was also kind of psychic. He could really look into people and tell what their character was. He could tell what they've done before. And that was his power, but it was kind of a curse because he would see all the bad in people. You know, he would see all the things they've done, you know, all their mistakes, all of their selfishness, all their greed, all everything. And so the story goes that he was in the presence of his master once, the Maggid of Mezrish, and someone came in and started bothering the Maggid, like some rich guy came in and started demanding that he have a blessing for this enterprise that he is getting involved with, and he's demanding the blessing from the master. And Reb Zusha tried to withhold himself for a while, and then he could no longer restrain himself, and he just yelled at him. And he said, "How dare you come and speak to my master like that when, you know, when you've done this and this and this?" And he just kind of rattled off. He's like, "Don't you have any shame? Like, don't you come with no humility, like, to standing before?" And the guy was completely shocked and just walks out. And so the Maggid gave Zusha a blessing. Not that he shouldn't be able to see anymore, but rather that he should be able to, he should see only the good in people as attributed to them. And when he sees the bad in people, that he wouldn't blame it on them. He would still see it, but he wouldn't see it as them. And in fact, he would actually take it to himself. He would take it to himself, but not in a way that was beating, not in a way it was beating himself up in the way that we think of it, where we blame everything on ourselves, but rather just in the sense of, in the sense of humility. Like, oh, it must have been some mistake that I made that caused blah, 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 blah. And that's what he would do. And so from then on, he was, he was known as always seeing the good in everything. And there's a story of it's actually Reb Pinchas and Reb Shmelki, who are brothers, and they also are disciples of the Maggid. And they come to the Maggid and they say, "What is this? What does it mean?" They come exactly with what you said, actually, because they come with a verse in the Mishnah that says you should give thanks even for the bad things, not just for the good things, but for the bad things. You should give thanks for everything. So they say, how can we give thanks for suffering? That doesn't make sense. Obviously, that would be insincere. We don't like our suffering. How can we give thanks for suffering? And the Maggid says, go talk to Reb Zusha. He'll answer the question. You'll find him smoking his pipe in the house of study. So they go and they find Reb Zusha and they ask him the question. And Reb Zusha just laughs and he says, you've made a big mistake. You've come to the wrong person. You know, you have to talk to someone who has suffered before, right? Someone who's going to tell you how to give thanks for suffering has to be someone who's suffered. I've never suffered in my life, so how can I possibly answer the question? And so it's not just about being open.
Wait, the rest of the story.
That's the rest of the story. That's
the next line in your, this is from your writing a couple weeks ago. The next line of the story is everyone knew Reb Zusha.
That's right. I'm sorry. Right. So they, because Reb Zusha was known to have a very difficult life of poverty and many tragedies that have happened to him. That was well known. So for him to say that he had never suffered was teaching them how to relate to suffering in a different way. So so that's kind of the next level up. Like, one level is just being able to be open and not getting trapped into having to protect yourself or getting fixated on the suffering. But then the next level is to actually reframe it, to choose how our mind works with it so as to see it as a blessing rather than suffering. And it's very powerful.
I have a question of the mind. So in this tradition, is the mind the enemy? since it's constricting and obscuring truth and creating walls?
No, it's just the using the mind in the way that does that. That's the enemy. Yeah, and so the traditional way that that's pictured, and there's lots of different, there's not one tradition, there's many, many different streams, different teachings about it, but it has to do with the directionality of the energy of the body and the mind. The mind and the body have a circular relationship, you know, and we know this from neuroscience as well, that there's this relationship between our emotions and our thinking and so on. So when emotional energy possesses the mind so that the mind becomes unconsciously controlled by emotional energy, then it's the enemy. But if we're awake, if we're aware, you need to have thought, you need to have your mind to do that, right? In order to have a still mind, you still have to have the thought of understanding the importance of a still mind. And so it's not about the mind being the enemy. It's about how to use the mind properly, and for the mind to be awake to what the mind is doing.
So you're saying the experience of transcending the mind allows one to use the mind differently,
and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Like just understanding intellectually the idea of transcending the mind can help you to practice it even before you've experienced it. Like we have to have an intellectual map of what we're talking about, even if we haven't experienced it very deeply yet, so that we can begin to practice. Yeah. All right. What time is it?
9:29.
Oh, okay. We're just in time. Signing off. Press the wrong button.
Are you going to do winter feast?
Just turn this off.